There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
We're pleased to have in the studio now an investor who believes that Asia has somewhat taken over from Europe and the US in the hearts and investment minds of Middle East investors. Pleased to say good morning to Mark Matthews, Singapore-based head of Research Asia for the largest Swiss private bank, Julius Baer, who also have a sizable operation here in Dubai. Good morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, Malcolm.
Thanks for joining us. Now, true to say, at the moment, there is some suspicion of the US at the moment from this part of the world, but Middle Eastern companies are still investing in US financial markets and still getting into the London property market big time, in particular the Platinum Triangle of Knightsbridge, Belgravia and Mayfair. So what research suggests that Asia is perhaps taking over from our affinity towards the US and Europe?
I think it's a matter of time, and it's inevitable that China's going to become the largest economy in the world. And the reason I say that is to quote Albert Einstein, the most powerful force in the universe is compounding. So if you look at what's driving world growth, China is contributing twice as much to world growth as the United States. So its economy is about $13 trillion. The United States is about $19 trillion. But last year, in the space of 12 months, China added an economy the size of Turkey to its GDP in just 12 months, and it's going to keep doing that. And so in a few years, it will be bigger, and it will be, therefore, much more meaningful part of the world economy than it is today.
Yeah, the growth numbers we hear out of China for the economy, out of Chinese companies, the sort of almost unbelievable amount when companies are sold, the huge, huge possibilities in China. One of the drawbacks, or two of the drawbacks, really, about China. One is sort of the veracity of Chinese government figures. And secondly, if you were to invest in the region, the lack of research in English or in Arabic to enable you to have a really good feel for Chinese companies. How is that improving?
It is improving. So the first thing on the macro data, the macro data is not incorrect. The numbers are right. And the reason I say that is that BlackRock, they did a regression analysis on the 30-odd high-frequency economic numbers that come out of China, going back as far as they could go. And they found, doing that regression analysis, that the actual GDP numbers over those same period of times were more or less correct. If anything, I think that their numbers are understated. On an aggregate basis, the economy is probably about 30% higher than we understand it to be because of the unofficial side of it. Now, in terms of the research, there is a lot of research on the so-called H shares. Those are the Chinese companies listed in Hong Kong, where there is much less research and therefore much more opportunity, frankly, because people have not invested in these stocks yet, is in the so-called A shares. Those are the companies listed in Shanghai. There's over 3,000 of them, and foreigners own less than 3% of that market.
What would you say then are the favored asset classes and investment vehicles for Middle East investors looking towards the Far East?
Well, I think that, unless you're going to dedicate a lot of time to this project yourself and do your own analysis, the best thing is to go with a fund. And the thing is that the easy way, of course, most of us would have to access markets around the world is these so-called exchange-traded funds, ETFs. And in a place like the United States, I would say by all means do that, because the best companies naturally get pushed to the top of something like the S&P index. In China, it's not that way because they have these huge state-owned enterprises which are still at the top of the index. So I think it's better off to let a fund manager decide which companies to invest in on your behalf.
Well, the big question of China, of course, as Malcolm alluded to earlier, is what's going to happen in terms of trade wars. People getting a little bit nervous about the tit-for-tat tariffs between the US and China, what it could mean for both the Chinese economy and companies. If you're an investor, what do you need to be thinking about and do you need to be concerned?
You do not need to be concerned, Brandy, and I think you have to understand the Chinese economy today is a very different economy from what it was 10 years ago. 10 years ago, it was about a $4 trillion economy. As I said to you earlier, by the end of this year, it'll be $13 trillion. Guangdong province alone is larger than the entire Russian economy. Shenzhen is larger than Sweden. Shanghai is the same size as Holland. Beijing is the same size as Switzerland. So exports as a percent of GDP are very, very small. They're about 5%, which is even less than the United States, by the way. So if this trade war doesn't escalate, well, of course, Boeing's going to be hurt. And of course, certain Chinese electronic manufacturers are going to be hurt. But in aggregate terms, it's not enough to bring down the economy. And I think the Chinese, you know, they're people who are working in their foreign service, who've been looking at the Americans since Nixon was president. They know the Americans very well, and I think they will be smart enough to offer the Americans some token to show they're trying to open up their economy, and maybe it'll be more than a token. Perhaps North Korea is part of this conversation. So I don't think we should worry. And then one final point I'll make is if you look at the stock market, less than 3% of stock market revenues in Hong Kong come from sales to the United States.
You mentioned there North Korea. I mean, as a long-term Asia resident, how are you handling questions about the sudden love-in between North Korea and the U.S., all happening a bit quickly?
Well, you know, it may well be that this is related to the trade spat in some way. And I was reading a report from the Financial Times last month, and it pointed out that Chinese imports of refined petroleum, coal, and steel from North Korea have basically ground to a halt this year. So the Chinese have been putting a lot of pressure, economic pressure, on North Korea, and it seems to be successful, clearly. You know, it's amazing because not everybody likes Donald Trump, let's put it that way. But I think 100 years from now, when historians look back on our time, and they won't be carrying the emotional baggage that we are today because, well, these people, they're not even born yet, I have a feeling that they will record him as having been one of the better presidents.
Now, that is interesting, and you're obviously looking at that, or we're looking at that now from an economic point of view. Other than the North Korea, what else do you think will make history judge him well?
The tax cuts are the big thing from an economic perspective. These are the largest tax cuts since Ronald Reagan's Tax Reform Act of 1986, and they're the major reason why the International Monetary Fund and other agencies have been keeping their world economic forecasts at a pretty strong rate of about almost 3.8 to 4% this year and next year. So I think the tax cuts are a big part of his legacy, making the country more competitive again, trying to build better infrastructure, of course. So yeah, there's a lot of good things actually that have happened since he took office.
We're looking towards the east this morning with the Singapore-based head of Research Asia for the largest Swiss private bank, Julius Baer, Mark Matthews. Mark, thanks for staying with us.
Thank you, Malcolm.
I guess first stop on the journey east from here probably wouldn't be China, but more likely to be India.
For you it is.
And the sort of Flipkart deal, the Walmart deal, shows the sort of level of interest in a corporate sense in India. What's your sort of view on investing in India? We've heard sort of, you know, from companies such as Vodafone and other big companies that it's fraught with danger to put big monies into India.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, of course, they're talking about billions and billions of dollars going directly into the economy. But I think as individual investors, it's perfectly fine for us to make an investment into that country over the longer term. Over the next, I would say, 12 to 18 months, I don't think it's really going to go very much anywhere, perhaps even down. I think, in fact, there's going to be an opportunity cost to being in India over the next 12 months.
Why is that?
It's because of politics. So I think where this started was back in November, December, when the Gujarat legislative assembly elections were held. Congress saw a substantial boost in the rural areas of Gujarat. And by the way, that's the Prime Minister's home state. So Congress went from 49 seats in the 2012 election to 60 seats in the 2017 election. And ever since then, people have been worried that BJP perhaps will not do as well in the general election, which will be held, I think, in April next year, as they did in the 2012 general election. And so we've got Karnataka coming up in a few weeks. That'll be a very important one to watch. But the problem for the market is that the more the government worries about not doing so well in next year's general election, the more it's likely to enact populist policies, which will require spending more government money. And that, in tandem with the higher oil price, will put pressure on India's current account deficit. And already the oil marketing companies in India are down to just a 2% margin. So if oil goes up any more, the government's going to have to fund them. And historically, when you get a wider current account deficit in India, you get a weaker rupee.
Asia, by far the biggest, most populous continent. And as a long-term Asia resident, you must watch all the sort of stress lines that are happening. China, Taiwan, at the moment, there's a certain amount of stress. There are Malaysian elections going on at the moment. What are the things that you're looking at the moment that perhaps concern?
Well, from a geopolitical standpoint, not much. In fact, I think since Trump won the election, the geopolitics have improved a lot, North Korea being the most obvious one. So I think the less the Americans are in that region and the Asians are left to their own devices, the nicer they're going to be to each other, as strange as that may sound, because the Japanese and the Filipinos know that they've got to basically manage their own relationship with China more than in the past. From an economic perspective, I also can't find a lot to complain about. The only thing I would point out to you, Malcolm, is that the debt-to-GDP ratio in China has gone from about 150% 10 years ago to over 250% today. Now, 250% debt-to-GDP is actually not a very high ratio by global standards. It's about the same as the UK, the United States. It's much lower than Japan. But it's the pace at which it rose that has a lot of people thinking that a good part of that debt is probably not very good debt. And in fact, about half of the loans made in China over the last 4 years were the so-called shadow banking sector. And shadow is the right word because we really don't know much about this stuff, but it's clear a lot of it is problematic. The good news is that Xi Jinping has chosen it as one of his top three priorities to deleverage, to tackle the shadow banking system. It has been shut down. The bad news is there's a lot of this stuff still floating around that's been securitized and trading. And for that reason, I believe that China deserves some discount, but I would argue that discount for the Chinese market is too extreme.
Do you see, as the Chinese are trying, that the UN will become a global currency?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, if you look back at the history of global reserve currencies, going back to the Portuguese Empire, they last around 100 years. And you could say that the dollar started as a reserve currency after World War I, so about 100 years ago. So as China becomes the largest economy in the world over, I would say, hard to gauge exactly when, but let's call it 5 to 10 years from now, and they gradually open up their capital account, I believe, yes, the renminbi will be a reserve currency. And in the beginning of a country becoming a superpower, their currencies are usually strong.
I'm interested in your take on tech, Mark, from an Asian perspective. We know that SoftBank, the Japanese multinational, is investing in everything right now with a lot of help from money from this part of the world. How does the average investor get in on that?
Well, there's obviously so many different ways. The most apparent one is in the United States, because in the United States, the technology sector is by far the largest sector in their stock market. It's about 25% of market capitalization. The top five stocks in the are all technology stocks: Facebook, Amazon, Apple, and the other two, but Google. The better place to be is in China, actually, because one problem that's going to become increasingly apparent, in my view, is that the technology companies are going to have to get more humble and less high-flying in the United States. We're talking about a handful of young men who've become the richest people in the world in a relatively short period of time, and they're now politically vulnerable. And it's easy to point fingers at them because many of these companies, like Google and Amazon, are clearly displaying monopolistic characteristics, and there are questions of invasion of privacy, etc. So I think the American tech companies are going to be burdened with that, but that doesn't exist in China. The Chinese government is very happy letting a handful of companies continue to do what they're doing. And when you just look at the growth prospects in China, I can't remember how many Chinese are connected to the internet now. I think it's around 600 million on a population base of 1.4 billion. There's so much more room for growth in the likes of Tencent, Alibaba, and Baidu.
What about things like, I mean, I was using the camera yesterday. A friend was showing me his camera on his Huawei phone, and it was amazing. South Korea as well. I mean, Samsung is the big one, but it's by no means the only tech player. Should we be looking more at the hardware particularly, but also the software coming out of South Korea and China?
Yes, I think you should. I mean, right now, you can't really invest in the hardware in China outside of a few big names like Sunny Optical. But I think this hardware components are promising thing longer term. And there you can talk about Samsung. You can also talk about Taiwan Semiconductor, which is probably the most advanced in this field. Because a lot of people think, myself included, that 5 years from now, the form factor that we will be using for technology isn't going to be these mobile phones anymore. We'll still use them to make phone calls. But basically, the internet will have morphed into what they call the Internet of Things. So it will be perhaps in our glasses or our contact lens. Even Facebook is working on our skin. It'll be all around us. And the point I wanted to make in that is all of that stuff is going to require a lot more semiconductors. Driverless cars as well will require about five times as much semiconductors as cars have today.
Well, listen, it's been fascinating talking to you. Thank you very much for joining us. Mark Matthews, Head of Research Asia at Julius Baer, based in Singapore. We do appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Malcolm.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.